And our guest tonight, Robert Young Pelton, and we're talking about things going on all around this planet. More to come when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Robert Young Pelton. Robert, as you look at all these world events that are unfolding right before us, as an American, you know, most people say, I don't care about what's going on in Somalia or here or there. It doesn't affect me. What do you say to them?
Well, it does at some point. I mean, I'm pretty sure that you can live in the Midwest and do what you want to do and not worry about world events and then suddenly find out that the dollar has slipped or the fuel you buy suddenly costs twice as much and then realize these things come from other countries and that things do affect you. I think it's hard to actually spend all day trying to figure out what should I do, you know, based on world events. But knowing what our government is doing in these places is very important because we think that there's some logic to it. And I think that's the part I find hard to track is when we go into a region like Iraq, you would almost think that there would be a benefit to Americans. And you find out that there actually is no benefit and actually a penalty because we spent a lot of money. And we pay an extraordinary amount for fuel. So what we're doing is actually the reverse of what nations used to do, which was to go into foreign countries or do foreign policy based on our best interest, or at least the population's best interest. So it's very important to hold the government accountable for these type of decisions because we always end up paying, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the road.
Is government still meddling with just about everything all over the planet?
Well, government is its own animal. It's got its own city. It lives in Washington, D.C. It makes decisions based on what it needs to do, and then we find out about it later. I mean, you saw what they can't even pass a budget, so they sit
right
there and they do what they do and take their salaries and complain about how tough things are, but I don't know how to connect with those people and make them change their ways or make them accountable. I know that I keep taking a larger and larger chunk out of my paycheck and sending it to that government, so I feel somewhat isolated.
Eric Haroun, let's go back to him. So what's going on with him now?
Well, this is an important thing because this is our government at its finest. Now, you know that the U.S. has decided to support the rebels against Bashar Assad, who's in power. And recently we pledged $12 million in non-lethal, but secretly what we're doing is we're providing things like weapons, RPGs, surface-to-air missiles through proxy governments. And we're working with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the UK to actually train these people so they can shoot down helicopters and be more effective. So Eric Haroun went there with a bunch of buddies to fight, and he did what the Syrian rebels do, which is run around and shoot at the government. And he got involved with a group that's considered to be part of al-Qaeda, not on purpose. He just ended up with them. He was actually held as a prisoner in the beginning, and then eventually he was allowed to run around and do his thing. Well, anyways, he gets out of the country, but he does an interview with an Israeli, it's called, I think, the Times of Israel, which then publishes it on a Fox News site, and they brand him as a terrorist, you know, American terrorist fighting in Syria. He gets very nervous. He goes to the FBI in the consulate in Istanbul, who actually has the article on his desk when he walks in. The CIA lady comes from downstairs, and they sort of whips on, good cop, bad cop. Now, Eric was in the military. He's a very patriotic American, spent 3 years in the military in a bridge-building unit.
Is he a mercenary?
No, he's just a kid. I mean, he's got, if you look at his Facebook page, he's got pictures of him driving around drunk in the middle of the night in Beirut and driving 120 miles in the Autobahn, smoking cigarettes, drinking. He's got tons of girlfriends. I mean, he's, you know, he's one of these guys that just likes to enjoy life.
Okay.
But he didn't choose the way things turned out. So he went into the embassy with the intention of basically coming clean and saying, wow, you know, I did this. Am I in trouble? And the FBI guy said, well, you're not supposed to fight in Syria. And he said, well, then I won't. I'm not going to do it anymore. And then they brought him back again for a 10-hour interview. And he just basically told him again. And then they went to his parents. And this is the most bizarre part of the story.
They're in Arizona, right?
Yeah, they live in Phoenix, Arizona. His dad's a retired truck driver. He's just a normal guy. The name Haroun, by the way, is English-Irish. It's not, you know, Middle Eastern.
It sounds Lebanese.
It does. It sounds very Lebanese, but it's not. It's actually an old English name. And his family's from Ohio. So the FBI knocked on his father's door and said, hey, we think your son's in a lot of trouble. We think there's a hit out on him. is there any way you can get him to come back to the States so he'll be safe? And they did the same thing at his sister's house. And they were terrified. They're thinking, oh, my God. I said, well, how can we get him home? And then because they don't have a lot of money, they said, well, if you give him a free ticket, I'm sure he'll come home. So the FBI gave Eric Haroon a ticket. When he got off the plane, he once again was interviewed by the FBI, who had him do his confession again, like, yes, I shot an RPG, and yes, I was with this group. And then they arrested him for firing an WMD, a weapon of mass destruction, which carries the death penalty if they want to stick it to him. And then they put him in solitary confinement where his dad has to pay $10 a minute to talk to his son, who's only allowed out between 3 and 5 a.m. out of the solitary cell in Alexandria, Virginia. So it's a real travesty.
Did somebody set him up?
Well, he was set up by this group of Israelis who initially found him, interviewed him, shared his videos over a group called Middle East called Memri, M-E-M-R-I, Middle East, and I don't know, but it's an intelligence organization run by an ex-colonel who was an Israeli intelligence officer. And the person that interviewed him got into a shouting match, and Eric, as he told me over the phone, was a very abusive, drawn-out shouting match about his views of Jews and Zionism and whatever. And Eric makes no secret about that he's not a fan of Israel. But the point is that he's not a fundamentalist. He's not crazy. Right, he didn't go to madrasa. He's not going to blow himself up. Anyways, that's what colored this whole thing. So the FBI basically tricked him into making a confession. But because he wasn't on American soil and they had no jurisdiction, they had to figure out how to trick him into getting back into the States, repeating his confession and then putting him in as a terrorist. And today he was in front of a judge asking if he can get out on bail. And the prosecution said, well, no, he's a member of Al-Qaeda. You can't let this guy out. He's a terrorist.
He lost that, then, did he?
Yeah, but I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to make him do a plea bargain like John Walker Lind. If you remember John Walker Lind in my time with him in 2001, they have the ability to use these terrorism laws, even on domestic people who are not necessarily terrorists, because it's basically, do you want to spend 20 years like this? And John Walker Lind is in solitary.
Well, now I'm a little confused in it. If he was on the side of the rebels, right?
Right.
And we support the rebels.
Correct.
So other than slapping his hand, why are we doing this to him?
Well, because during one combat operation, they did a joint operation with a group called Al-Nusra, which is a franchise of Al-Qaeda. It used to be Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
All right. They were part of the rebel group.
Right. And they were part of this operation. There was a lot of shooting and confusion, and he jumped on the back of the truck of one of these Al-Nusra guys, who then held him, I wouldn't say hostage, but held him as a prisoner because he was an American. And then after a while, they let him go, and they gave him some weapons. They gave him an RPG and an AK, and apparently he did engage in some fighting. But once again, he's under the sway of this group. He's not about to say, hey, screw you, I'm not going to fight with you.
But, I mean, he went there to fight, didn't he?
He went to fight with the Free Syrian Army, which is the official, you know, the U.S., I wouldn't say back, but the one U.S.-supported group that is fighting to overthrow Bashar Assad.
Are the Israelis backing the rebels?
No, they're terrified of the rebels.
Sorry, as you were saying, they don't want the rebels. They would prefer Assad to stay there.
Right, and because that's the devil.
All right,
you
so
know.
Why are we supporting the rebels if Israel doesn't want the rebels in?
Once again, you asked me in the beginning what I think of the government. I don't know. It's almost like they're doing the exact wrong thing again. But the problem is there's over 20 groups fighting there. It's much like Libya. You know, there's just a hodgepodge of groups fighting.
Okay. It's all out of control.
Exactly. And so when you pour gasoline on a fire, it actually burns a lot brighter and creates a third effect, which is an entire region out of control.
So the mistake the American made was going there in the first place.
Well, typically what we're supposed to do is either stay out of a conflict because it's none of our business or get into a conflict. So, for example, in Libya, we did a very smart thing. We spent billions of dollars supporting an air campaign, a no-fly zone, we called it, which sounds very polite. But basically, we took out all the aircraft, tanks, heavy artillery, command and control centers, which allowed the rebels to take over much quicker. We don't do that in Syria. I don't know why. So we're letting people die every single day, needlessly, I think. If we're going to overthrow Assad, just go in there with their air force, take them out, and get out.
And be done with it.
Right, and this is the new face of war, is that we don't want boots on the ground. We want to use our technology, and we want to end these things quickly.
Robert, here's one of my concerns, and look at it from the perspective of Russia and China. Here's America, involved in Iraq, involved in Afghanistan, involved in Korea, involved in Syria, all over the place. At what point do these two superpowers say enough is enough?
Well, we don't, because it's projection. Would we allow
the Russians to do what we're doing?
No, and this is something that somebody will twig on one of these days. But, you know, the whole idea of using drones and proxy armies and things like that. What if the other side starts doing that? You know, what if Russia backed a Mexican cartel to go kill people in Texas? What if drones came into Los Angeles and took out, you know, the mayor?
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the things that are on the very near horizon. They're not science fiction scripts.
And you may not know where the drones came from.
Well, I'll tell you a chilling story. A friend of mine, who's an old Navy captain, bought a drone. You know those consumer drones that you can take pictures with?
You've probably
seen them on TV.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're about $6,000. He loves this thing because he puts his camera on there and he does wildlife and ocean photography. And then we're having lunch and he says, Robert, do you know something that really scares me? And as an ex-military guy, he said, do you know that you can program drones to sit in one place and to start all by themselves, go to a prearranged location and do something? Which means that you could have the Super Bowl and you could have drones sitting on the rooftops at 20 different places with explosives, and then on command they all take off and do something.
And there's no way you could stop them.
And there's no way you could trace it. And that fear alone is what made them think this is not good. I mean, this technology is so dangerous right now. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, I can go on the internet and buy a drone. You're supposed to have an FCC license to operate it, but I don't necessarily need one. And you put this in the hands of a lone wolf or a terrorist
organization, or
a proxy group, and you've got horrible mayhem. Forget nukes. Forget
9/11. You wouldn't need to do that.
Right. And, you know, you've seen the things with the sort of currency meltdowns and cyber warfare and things that aren't sexy. You don't see them in movies a lot, but they're very real things where you can go into a power plant and you can shut down a power plant. Now, we had a power outage here in Southern California for 3 days. And my daughter, who's a young sort of...
That was about a year ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. Right. Could not buy gas because gas pumps weren't electricity.
3 million people knocked out then.
Couldn't get money because her ATM card didn't work.
That's right.
Couldn't charge her cell phone and would have to plug it into a car, but a car needs gas, and couldn't get either to work or home. And all of a sudden, you realize how easy it is to cripple society. So add this to the thing we're talking about with the angry youth, and think about what a lot of smart, hip people might do if they were angry at a government. It wouldn't be guns. It wouldn't be people shooting at people.
Be drones.
Things that slowly disassemble society, whether it's hacking and releasing people's phone numbers. You've seen all these high-level people that have had their stuff exposed. So that's what I see. It's almost like a guerrilla warfare without bullets.
So we're going to have 30,000 drones flying over the states. I'm sure one of them is going to hit a commercial plane once. Almost did over New York, didn't it? I think
drones are funny things. They are incredibly smart, and they can be used for a variety of applications, and they can be used for good and bad, of course.
And it would seem to me that they would be easily accessible in the wrong hands.
Well, you can build them yourself. I mean, you don't need to spend a lot of money to build a drone. But when you say the wrong hands, now we're also assuming that the government's the good guy. So
yeah, we have to for a moment.
But we're entering an era where the government is becoming kind of a bad guy, you know, doing its own thing and taking more and more money from people and getting people angry. And you've seen the back and forth we have between the right and the left wing about every issue that comes up. You're not getting a sense of consensus and forward movement anymore. You're just getting a sense of constant arguing and lethargy and inaction.
Where's this headed?
Well, you saw Arab Spring, right?
I did, and I was marveled by it because it was everywhere. It took down Gaddafi. It took down Mubarak.
It started with one guy who was a fruit seller, who's tired of paying bribes, and he burns himself alive. And that triggered people to think, oh, my God, this is it. That's enough. We're not going to take any more of this crap. So these things are triggered by one singular event. You remember the movie Network with a...
I loved it. Howard Beale, mad as hell, not going to take it anymore.
Exactly. One guy takes up the baton and just says, screw it, we're not going to take it anymore. And Arab Spring was an exact example of that. When people all protest at the same time, the government flees or is overthrown.
Scary times, Robert.
Well, I think so, because I've been around for a while. You know, I'm 57. I've been to a lot of countries. I've been into a lot of countries that are completely chaotic, like Liberia and Afghanistan. And I've watched them both build governments, and I've watched them both overthrow governments. And we think that won't happen here, but it actually is very easy to do.
We are, as people here in this country, we're propped up. We're massaged. We feel as if, okay, the economy's not busting along at the pace it should. But those who are working are doing okay.
Right.
Those who aren't, they're not. But, you know, by and large, most people are plodding along. You know, the restaurants are full on weekends. The sporting venues are full during these games. Baseball has started. People don't realize what the possibility might be, do they?
Well, but there's a whole underground economy. That's the normal people. Those aren't the people with cardboard and Sharpies. You know, those aren't that huge army of people that you notice when you drive around that don't seem to have jobs or have anything. And this, I mean, you know, the number of homeless people, the number of homeless vets, people who have nothing, is growing every day. It's not shrinking. You know, the net is gone. There's no way you can go into this country and live off of handouts and Social Security. You join this black economy where you can't get the credit rating to get an apartment. Therefore, you become homeless. You know, you can't buy a car. You can't afford gas. So these things are pushing more and more people below that level.
The people that you see at corners, the pregnant lady with the dog, and you know, and the guy there with them, are they really destitute or is this a scam?
It's a business. It's like the guy with the priest collar at the airport that wants you to donate to some generic charity.
And he's not a priest.
No, and he's who knows what he does with the money. But I mean, you know, there is a little bit of that, but most of these people are forced to do that. So whether you're waving a sign for minimum wage or whether you're begging or whether you've got a cardboard sign, that's not a healthy thing. You know, those people should have real jobs and they should have homes and they should have all the things that we're supposed to have.
Is it because they can't get it or they don't want to get it?
Ooh, you know, I used to live in a car when I was 16. And
you lived in a car?
Yeah, I lived in a Rambler Classic station wagon.
What do you mean you lived in it?
Well, I was homeless. I got kicked out of the house, and I had to pick fruit, and I lived in a car. It's just, you don't just buy a house when you're homeless and penniless. You survive.
It's not.
And the bottom line is that it's like Grapes of Wrath. There's a huge, huge world of people out there who don't have credit cards, who don't have cell phones, who don't have, you know, money in the bank or even a bank account. You know, think of the migrants that come here illegally. They have nothing. Think of the people that lost their homes but don't have any cash and don't have relatives, you know.
How long will the have-nots put up with it?
You know, I don't know. I wish I had, like, a crystal ball and I could tell you, but...
I bet you do.
We push for socialism, but we don't seem to have much impact on that level of people. And the only reason I bring this up is because... In Arab countries, you have a much, much higher percentage of young people who are
destitute.
Without jobs, without future, and that translates directly into anger.
And look at what's happening.
Yeah.
Look at, you know, it's contained here somewhat, even though we have a high crime rate. Robert, when we come back, I want to talk with you about guns and what's going on there and get your take on that. Robert Young Pelton, our special guest, is a number of books, including License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. His website's both linked up at coasttocoastam.com. As for me, if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Back in a moment with Robert Young Pelton as we continue on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, give you an opportunity to participate in the program as we take phone calls with Robert Young Pelton. And I'll be back with him, more to chat with him about on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Young Pelton with us. As we look at this planet as a whole. So as we talk about the haves and the have-nots, what about the gun situation, Robert? I mean, there's no question government would like to get some restrictions on guns. Where do you see this all headed?
Well, I think the argument is emotionally driven and is going to lead to no net gain, because the real issue is violence in America. I mean, we have to talk about why would somebody die of a violent event, not just glory killers, you know, the guys that go in and shoot a bunch of people and blow their brains out, which is a small statistical element of that, but the actual use of violence. And if you take that up into the gun arena, in other words, guns are a cause of violence, you'd have to look calmly at the statistical use of guns. And then the biggest single use of in gun violence is essentially black-on-black, lower-income, urban use of guns against each other. You have suicides. You have things that have nothing to do with real murders or school shootings. So can you regulate that? Not really. I mean, can you go out into society and pull every gun out of everybody's hands and say we've solved violence? No. If you look at places like the UK, they're obsessed with knives now. You know, they've cracked down on guns, and now they're cracking down on knives. It's not the legal people that break the law. You know, someone that owns a weapon, I own a weapon. I don't go out and shoot people. I have no intent of doing so. And if I was asked by my community to pick up that gun and defend something or somebody, I would do so. But, you know, I've been many places with many guns, and I have no fetish for them. Mm-hmm. And I respect my neighbor's right to have a weapon as well. But my biggest concern is not the gun, not the size of the magazine, not the color of the gun or how it's designed, whether it's called an assault rifle or a sporting rifle. It's people who are so angry or so frustrated or so mentally unhinged that they want to use that gun to kill other people or themselves. That's the issue.
That is the issue. Sure.
But you can't regulate. You can't stop crazy.
No, you can't stop it. I mean, had the mother in Sandy Hook had her guns locked up, there's a good possibility that kid could not have gotten them, obviously.
Well, but once again, these are things that are common sense. These are things that people should have access to, like, you know, safety and use of a gun, safety and use of a vehicle, safety and use of prescription medicines. I mean, you know, these are just educational things. But in most shootings, you have someone who takes a legally registered gun and does something illegal with it. So if laws prevented that, there would be none of that going on right now. If you want to look at guns as the cause of violence, America's not really that big a deal. If you go to the Honduras or Central America, oh my God, I mean, gun violence is out of control there. Once again, laws don't stop people from using weapons on each other. So the argument goes around and around, and I don't think the NRA is doing themselves any favors by saying, oh, you're a teacher here, take this handgun and take it to school with you. I don't think that makes me feel better about how schools conduct themselves. Mental health officials are saying, okay, if you want me to rat out everybody who feels angry, your jail is going to be pretty full pretty fast. So the mental health side of it is pretty tricky as well. So it really comes down to community policing. You know, are there crazy people? Are there people who yell at you all the time and threaten you? You know, these are things that society used to take care of by themselves. And that's been taken away from us.
There are some, Robert, who think that some of these events are staged. They're false flags. You know, these kids are manipulated. And there's no doubt in my mind they're on prescription drugs because of their own problems. But I wouldn't go as far as to say that they're the Manchurian candidates.
I'll say something interesting. Take a television, put it in front of a baby, and turn it on. It immediately goes into a trance.
Yeah.
The television off, it starts walking around.
It's a babysitter.
Turn it back on, the child goes into a trance. Now, take a light bulb and flash it on and off in front of your face as many times as a TV flashes. What you get is this bizarre sort of, almost like you talk about the Manchurian candidate. It is how people used to be brainwashed, is by punching thousands of images and ideas into their heads that they don't even know are in their heads. So when that person is on medication or they get frustrated, that is how they act out. They see things as random and abstract and violent. And then when the adrenaline wears off and they realize what they've done, they have no problem lifting that gun up and shooting themselves in the head. These are all pre-programmed things they've seen on TV, things they know what to do. Nobody takes suicide training. And nobody takes, you know, mass shooter training. But these things are very, very similar.
Well, but are you saying that these mass killers are programmed killers?
They're programmed by media. I mean,
not intentional.
Well, look at me. Look at what your kids are watching.
Well, here, let me rephrase it. They're not being programmed to go out and kill people.
No, there isn't. Metallica's not singing kill, 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 or, you know, playing the record backwards causes people to do crazy things. I'm saying look at the envelope of media, the wall of imagery that children are exposed to, whether it's shooter games on videos or whether it's rock videos. I mean, it's an extremely intense barrage of imagery, and a lot of it has to do with violence and sex. And people think, oh, what has sex got to do with violence? A lot of violence comes from sexual frustration. And so these kids are not able to cope with this surge of emotions and hormones and whatever. And they're also on medication, which sort of alters their view of the world. So they choose this bizarre, I mean, why wouldn't they shoot themselves first rather than shoot a bunch of people?
Exactly, in the confines of their home.
Well, this is almost like a cult-like activity. When you think about what these kids are, they tend to be quiet loners. I mean, they spend a lot of time engaged in online chats and playing games and things like that. They have very similar backgrounds to them. And I'm not a psychiatrist, but I can tell you that people who grew up away from television, away from this sort of bombarded reality, actually talk to people and have people around them in their village that discipline them, that say, hey, you're out of line. Don't yell at that person. Don't throw that rock. And what you'll find is a much healthier society when you're away from that electronic bombardment.
We used to have stories every day about piracy. Where'd it go?
You know, that was my expertise. You know, I worked in Somalia for 2 years chasing pirates, and they gave up. They suddenly realized that when they go out to ships now, what they did was a very strange thing. They put armed guards on ships just like the old days, and they said, go ahead, shoot back. So if a pirate comes up to you, shoot him. And all of a sudden, the pirate who can't swim 100 miles from shore suddenly says, oh, I don't think I want to die out here. So that dramatically curtailed almost all pirate activity. And then there was another unit that was on land that I was with called the Puntland Marine Force. They were chasing pirates on land, and to the point when one of the pirates actually contacted me. He had an oil tanker, and he was scared to get off the ship because he was going to get his multi-million-dollar ransom. And he wanted to figure out if there was a way they could be rescued or arrested at sea so they wouldn't be killed when they got on land. So they basically had all their avenues cut off from them. But the people that made most of the money are the security contractors and insurance companies.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, all the time. So where do you see this planet headed? What's Robert Pelton?
Well, I look to the little things now. You know, I don't try to change the world. I work on it one person at a time. I try to remove people's fear. I try to say to them that if you get out there and you go to these places and you meet these people, they're a lot less scary. Things make a lot more sense, and you come back with some interesting solutions because everybody around the world is solving the same problems. They have different ways of going about it. When you bring those things back to your community, you're basically cross-pollinating ideas that work in other regions. And the second thing is I see a growing lack of interest in what we call government. I mean, the idea that we used to get together and form our little units and say, okay, let's pave the roads or let's, you know, guard this or do that, it seems to be vanishing. The idea that you can move government without billions of dollars at your disposal. So I'd like to see a turn back to the grassroots type of government where individual states, instead of arguing through the media, through lobbyists in Washington, can actually solve their own problems. So if one area doesn't want guns or doesn't want signs painted yellow, they can change that, as opposed to nationally sort of bogged down ideas.
Well, I don't know where it's all going to head, Robert.
Well, if you knew,
it's going to hit ahead.
You'd be in the stock market, and you wouldn't be doing this show. So.
I'd still do this show, but I'd be in the stock market.
It's like, if you had a time machine, the first thing you do is grab the Wall Street Journal from 20 years ago.
Then I'd buy more lottery tickets.
Exactly.
How about you? What about travel? What's up for you?
I'm kind of locked down now writing books. I'm going to go out to Atlanta for a knife show because my company, DPX Gear, makes knives and tactical gear. And I'm going to spend some time with my grandson, which I find like the Godfather, you know, at the very end, that I enjoy quite a bit because nothing is more amazing than someone learning all the things that you got tired of even thinking about.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that.
I'm going back to St. Louis in a few weeks for my granddaughter's baptismal.
And that's where the hope is. I mean, don't try to convince a 70-year-old guy to change the government, but talk to a 5-year-old, and they're eager to try anything. So that's kind of fun.
We're coming up on April 25th, which is the TSA kick-in date on 2.36-inch knives on planes. I had you on a few weeks ago. We were reacting to it. I got to tell you, you know, airline flight attendants, pilots, people are appalled by this. You can inflict some bodily damage with a 2.36 inch knife, can't you?
You can do it on yourself, too, if trying to cut an apple. Yes, of course. And as I told you last time, that I have no problem with carrying heavy machine guns on aircraft, which I do all the time when I'm in war zones. But I don't like intimidating or scaring or putting fear into the idea of flight crews who have gone through a very horrific experience, you know, with 9/11.
Yes.
With very small box cutters. So if you need a knife on a plane, I don't know what you're doing, whittling or something, but, you know, just put it in your luggage. And then, and like I say, I make knives, so I should be the last person to say this, but any tool should be used appropriately around the people that you're with. So.
Well, and I think, I mean, here we go, it's almost like guns. You know, the good people with guns are only going to use it for protection. So do you think that once this thing is implemented, and let's hope it gets repealed, but that law-abiding citizens should go out and get these 2.36 inch knives, which of which I can't find, by the way.
No, and, well, they're European ones. You remember they lobby. These are all the Swiss Army knives and the little nail. These are all European knives, not American.
I mean, everybody that is a law-abiding person, if this becomes law, should carry one just for your own protection on a plane, shouldn't you?
No, I'm going to take a hockey stick, which I'm now allowed to take.
Yeah, I mean, what if the guy next to you is some crazed lunatic, and he starts, you know, pulling out this knife and he's playing around with it? I mean, what are you going to do?
I don't know, and I don't.
Does he have the right? Once this is law, and you can take it on a plane,
right.
Does he have the right to sit next to you with that knife in his hand?
You know, it doesn't. Like I said, it doesn't bother me, but it makes other people extremely nervous, and so I have to respect that.
I would be nervous if there was a guy sitting next to me with a knife out, wouldn't you?
Not really, because I sit around with people that are stoned out of their minds with AK-47. So I think, you know.
Well, not on a commercial plane.
Well, in some countries, yes, you take dead bodies, mortar rounds, you know. But yes, in America, where it's customary to just sit there and strapped in and watch bad movies, you don't need a knife.
No, you don't need a knife. So tell me this: how in God's name did the head of TSA get this approved?
Well, what happened was the Europeans, the people that make these little cheap knives, you know, the Wenger. And
the ones that are getting confiscated all the time.
Right, the ones that your grandmother carries probably, because I don't know anybody that carries a 2.5 non-locking knife, lobbied Congress to say, oh, well, you know, they're going to allow these in other countries. So in order to make these laws equitable, because, you know, laws are different. You can have something taken away from you in London that's perfectly legal over here.
That's right.
So their concept was, well, we lobbied the heck out of Europe, so we're going to do it over here. And the TSA was not necessarily opposed to banning anything because they have much bigger problems with chemicals and flammable things and underwear bombers and, you know.
And take your shoes off and everything else.
Right. And so the logic was that if they're looking for knives, it just takes time and it slows them down. But the reality is that now they have to measure if you're
2.6
or 2.5 and, you know, doesn't lock or does lock. So it's a ridiculous exercise, and it's a very governmental exercise.
And do you measure the blade from the blade portion on back, or who knows?
It's they're exactly designed for European knives. You see what I mean? If you look at the TSA website, they have all these pictures, and the things you're not supposed to carry are the things that Americans typically do carry, like hunting knives or folding knives or things like that.
I got to tell you, I'm appalled by the decision. I really am.
Well, once again, go ahead, push a button, and change that decision. It ain't going to happen. And that's what I talked about, where I'm in the knife industry. Nobody asked my opinion, and they went ahead and did this, and I still scratch my head and say, why didn't you ask somebody who knows something?
Who makes them? It's a living. you would have said, you don't need this.
Yeah, it baffles me. And then obviously the sporting goods industry was on their game, because they got them to allow baseball bats, wiffle bats, hockey sticks.
Yeah.
Things like that, which is even more lethal than a 2-inch knife or a 2.5.
What's going to happen the next time some idiot goes nuts on a plane and uses one of these things to do something?
We'll read about it.
And it will happen. It will happen.
It's legal now. But we'll read about it in the paper, and it'll be something that we joke about, but nothing will happen. That's how government works. They make dumb decisions, and then they move on from that.
I mean, they're going to allow baseball bats?
Well, they had a problem with breast milk once. Remember that?
I remember that.
They had a big problem with, should you taste your own breast milk before you're allowed on a plane, even though your baby can't drink anything else? I mean, it's ridiculous. So they don't know what to do. And, you know, to be honest, the TSA, I think it's an $8 billion racket.
Where's the leadership, though? I mean, how come we're not having senators or the president or somebody go to the TSA and say, no? It's been an unfortunate situation since 9/11, but it's worked, you know?
Well, here's how it's supposed to work. It actually was very simple. When you went on a plane, you took any dangerous object, you gave it to the attendant or somebody that they put it in a bag, and they put it in the cockpit with the pilot, and at the end of the flight, they handed it back to you. If you carried a pistol, you carried a knife, you carried whatever. And everybody was fine with that idea until they came up with the TSA. Now we have millions of people rummaging through our luggage looking for things like flashlights or pointy things or whatever that don't actually make flying safer. They just make it take longer. So there's no accountability. There's no sort of, you know, measurement of how safe or unsafe we are. And I'm not down on TSA employees. I mean, they have a job to do. They get yelled at, you know, cursed at, whatever. But it's just one of those meaningless do loop things that they do. It's got nothing to do with safety.
It's crazy. You can't take a 4.0 fluid ounce little bottle of shampoo. It's got to be 3.5 or less. But you can bring that knife in a few more weeks.
Yeah, and you know, they don't know if they should sniff you or X-ray you or pat you up. And one of the funny things is I'm tall, so when I go through those X-ray machines, my hands stick out, and they yell at me to hold my hands up high.
Exactly.
And when I get up, because it's not in the imagery, they feel my fingers to see if I'm hiding something in my fingers.
I was on a flight a few weeks ago, and I had to take my belt off, took my shoes off, took everything out of my pocket, and while I'm up there with my hands over my head, the guy says, I kid you not, Robert, pull up your pants. And I said, what? I mean, they were already pulled. My belt was off. And I said, you've told me to keep my hands over my head, and now you're telling me to pull up my pants. When I'm supposed to use my teeth? And I said, why? And he said, well, we want to make sure we get a better reading. And it made no sense.
Well, it's a government thing. Why should it? I mean, once again, if a person says, look, I want to be safe, tell me how you're making it safer, they would have a hard time telling you how to make something safer or less safer. All they do is they do what it's supposed to do, and every year they run tests where people put weapons through there, they put drugs through there, whatever, and they fail consistently.
You know, on the day it's supposed to be law, April 25th, I believe, I would love it if every pilot and flight attendant decided not to fly.
That's an interesting idea.
That's the only way it's going to stop.
Well, here's the thing. I have a lot of respect for captains. And if a captain says, hey, guys, do this or don't do that or sit down, I do exactly what he says, even though I may not agree.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with flight attendants, who can be very irritating sometimes. But they're there when you go down. And I've had a plane crash. And they're there to save your life. So you basically have to just shut up and do what they say.
That's right.
But they're in charge. And it's a private enterprise. And you have to do what they're told. So once again, I think it's up to them what goes on their plane.
You know, I've only had one bad experience with a flight attendant ever in my life. As I was going down the aisle and she was in the way, I kind of put my arm on her shoulder and she went ballistic. And that was it. Robert, we're going to come back and take some phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.